Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. Hi there, good to be with you. Well, economics, politics and values have dominated the week. Yes, it was the budget, and it managed to generate a welter of column inches on each of those topics. Shortly, we'll take a look at Australian aspirations for the good society and how our budget process reflects them. Our panel will include economics columnist Ross Gittins, Lynn Hadfield-Dodds of Uniting Care, and Frank Quinlan of the Mental Health Council. In our second hour this evening, we'll be joined by Stephen Crittenden, who'll join us for a look at some of the significant news stories in religion over the past week. And of course, they've been both national and international. Nationally, we've had the continuing controversy over the sacking of Bishop Bill Morris. Internationally, the death of Osama bin Laden and the reaction in religious communities, particularly Muslim communities around the world. We'll pick up some of those issues with Stephen in about an hour's time. Then we'll be joined by Gary Gach, author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Buddhism. Gary Gach was in Australia recently and joined us on Sunday night for a bit of a chat. Then the quiz, Noel will be along in his quest for the good life, and Bill Ledbetter will join us in the chat room to pick up your concerns about the week and perhaps any other issues you wish to canvass. All budgets are constructed to achieve economic ends, but within a political framework. This budget, perhaps more so than most. Budgets are also an expression of philosophy, and as such an expression of how we see ourselves as a society, or what perhaps we aspire to be. Sometimes they are coherent, sometimes less so. What's perhaps most interesting about this budget is not so much its content, but its reception. Damned as being not tough enough, yet on the other hand accused of launching class warfare on middle income earners. Well, we'll get to some of that later. But first, let's get to the substance of the budget itself. It's a pleasure to welcome into the studio this evening economics columnist Ross Gittins. Ross, good to have you with us.
My pleasure, John.
Lynn Hadfield-Dodds of Uniting Care. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, John.
And Frank Quinlan. Now, Frank, formerly of Catholic Social Services, but this evening, for the first time, wearing your new hat with the Mental Health Council, Executive Director, I understand.
Yeah, thanks, John. And a lovely hat it is, too. It's a very exciting place to be.
Well, particularly at the moment. We'll get to that in a moment. Ross Gittins, first of all, how responsible a budget was this, given the political constraints, I guess not the least of which is the parliamentary minority that the government finds itself with?
Well, I think it was quite a responsible budget from an economic point of view. We can argue about other policy aspects of it. But they believed that they needed to get the budget back to surplus fairly quickly. I actually support that because it is clear that we're going into another very big mining boom, that there's going to be a huge amount of construction of new mines in Australia, that probably run for the decade. And that could very easily, like other resource booms, end in tears with inflation and a recession and higher unemployment. You really have to ride these things properly, and I think it's very good that the government is hauling in its stimulus to the economy, withdrawing it actually, so that we don't have a complete reliance on interest rates. And because the more we have to rely on interest rates to slow things down and ensure that the place doesn't just explode, then that will help to put upward pressure on the dollar, which nobody wants. Oh, well, maybe some tourists want, but I don't think...
Yes, I'm planning, the holes
sorry,
later on in the
sorry.
Year.
So I think it was a good budget, and the government has put a lot of effort into that. You can say they were doing that for political reasons. I'm sure the political reasons are very strong, but there is also a strong economic rationale for doing that.
Well, you mentioned the need to haul it in, as it were, haul expenditure in to get ready for the shocks that are to come. In that context, how tough was it?
Well, it could have been tougher. It could always have been tougher. It's impossible to satisfy economists who want you to cut spending and don't like to see tax increases. By the way, one of the ways that the deficit is being turned into a surplus is by not having any more tax cuts until we're well down the road of getting back to surplus and starting to pay off the debt that we built up during the downturn. So it's not all happening on the spending side. And by the way, when you talk about cuts, there are cuts, but there's still has still got their spending growing by 1% in real terms.
Now, on the cuts issue, there seemed to be some confusion in the media this week. On the one hand, you had cuts to lower income earners. There were some cuts to, or perhaps not so much cuts, but sort of carrots and sticks on the issue of upskilling people, getting them into employment. On the other hand, you had screams about $150,000 people on those earnings having their benefits cut and this being terribly tough. So not tough enough, too tough. Yeah, there's very mixed messages coming through the media
well,
this week.
Yes, and a lot more about toughness on the top than toughness at the bottom. When we talk about the bottom, by the way, we're talking about the very bottom, people on welfare benefits. They've been subjected to stick as well as some carrot. But right at the top, and not the middle. And I mean, it's an obscenity to describe someone on 150 or even a family on 150,000 a year as being middle. They're not middle. They're right near the top. They're at least the top 20%, if not higher. And if you're in the top 20%, you cannot say you're in the middle. I think, you know, you get these economists saying, why weren't you tougher? And what they want is a reeling back of what's called middle-class welfare, and they are complaining because there wasn't enough of it, but then they retire and in come the people who are whinging like mad about measures that the economists thought were, you know, thrashing people with a feather.
So we've got a mixture of politics and economics here, as we always do, and opinions sort of being hauled in either direction as to the merits of that. Let's go to the big promised delivery. And Frank Quinlan, let me bring you in here. Mental health. This does seem to be unequivocally received as a promise delivered and a good one.
Indeed, John. And I think what's interesting about it, just picking up on some of Ross's comments, is that it seems to have, in my view, it can be measured successfully both from a political point of view and from an economic point of view. So, because what we've seen in the reaction, it was very interesting and during the week coming home very late when they were running out of things, I think, to say in the commentary on the news and were interviewing Vox Pop style. The number of people who were really warmly receiving the mental health initiatives, even without knowing the sort of full details of the packages, was, I think, quite striking, and I think that's had some resonance through the rest of the course of the week. And it's no surprise, I guess, with so many families and people touched by mental health issues. But the other side of that I think is perhaps easy to overlook is that it's a sound economic investment. I won't bore you with statistics, but we know that something like 400,000 years of healthy life lost each year due to mental illness. That's about 14% of our total health burden. So we know that investments in preventing that loss of life and that enormous health burden that we carry really have very lasting effects on the economy. And I think one of the things that we've not seen for a long time is some of these long-term investments in economic outcomes for the community.
How much of this is upfront now and how much of this is never-never?
Look, it's a fair bit of a spread across the 5 years, and it's interesting that most of this package has been estimated across the 5 years. I say with some caution, though, that frankly, to roll out a very, very substantial investment takes time if it's going to be done properly. The mental health sector, both from the clinical perspective where a lot of services are delivered, but also in the community sector, where the community sector is the first point of call for many people who need assistance with mental illness. They're tremendously run down, really. They're not providing and not able to provide anything like the sorts of services that are required. So it will take some time to build up that capacity. What we see in the package, though, and it's only a small part of the package, but what we do see in the package is an investment in a 10-year plan and an investment in an independent commissioner to monitor and report to the Parliament on the progress of the package, and to build up a longer-term plan with state and territory governments to ensure that the investment over that longer-term period is maximised.
In a policy area, Frank Quinlan, does this mark the a sea change in what has been a policy retreat in mental health ever since the days, I think it was, of the Richmond Report, which began the retreat into deinstitutionalisation and effective abandonment of much of the mental health area?
Well, look, I heard it, a comment attributed during the week to Patrick McGorry. I don't know whether he made it or not, but I thought it captured the sense of where we are, that there's really a lot of unfinished business in relation to the deinstitutionalisation. So there were enormous changes made. A lot of the services on the ground were either never funded adequately or never developed the way they should have been. And so I think we've carried a fair burden of that until now. And
well,
I think
a lot of the mental health stuff, just sticking on that deinstitutionalisation stuff at the moment, got transferred into the general welfare sector, as you saw people into boarding houses who really had borderline mental instabilities. Those boarding houses ultimately were serviced by church and charities running feedings programs and meals programs. So this is a sort of multidimensional thing here.
That's exactly right. And certainly if you wanted to find many people experiencing severe and debilitating mental illness, then many of those people are going to be found in our prisons, in our homeless shelters and in our social services. And that's still the case today. What we saw was the deinstitutionalisation of many of those patients. But as you say, the generalisation of many of the services that were meant to support them. And this budget has really made some very substantial investments in some of the early intervention programs and some of the treatment programs. Still some investment yet to be made, I think, in terms of particularly some of the support to carers and others. But I described on the budget night, I think, as starting a bit of an unstoppable momentum, really. I think this change has found resonance in the community, and as a result of that, I think it's likely to be something that's going to be hard to step back from.
And there is a philosophical change being signalled as well.
Well, as I said at the outset of my comments, it is a philosophical change. It's an investment in very substantial services and some new models of service, but also some support for some old ones.
Just one indication. Give us perhaps what you would consider the two priorities that will get funded immediately.
Well, people will have heard of the Headspace Centres and the Epic Centres, which are particular clinical support services for young people. But what I think is going to be a really game-changing sort of investment is the expansion of services in the personal helpers and mentors and in intensive case support for people in the community. And we're not sure exactly how that will roll out, but if it rolls out well, what that will mean is that people experiencing mental illness will have no wrong entry point into the system, which is just a bit of a jargony way of saying whether you turn up at your school counsellor, your unemployment service, your homeless shelter, or your GP, you will get access to the services that you need and a planned, sustained approach to the support that you require in the community.
Because individual case management has then been the bete noire of many government services over the years, as much has been promised and little delivered. So, again, we're in the situation of wishing well and hoping well and trusting that that individual case management will mean what it's supposed to mean. Lynn Hadfield-Dodds is probably an appropriate place to bring you in here, because case management is one of the issues that it goes across the welfare community, and how to deliver services in ways that aren't fractured. Can you give us your views, first of all, on the upside of the budget as far as the welfare community, particularly your perspective at Uniting Care, is concerned?
I think the day after the budget, we put out a media release that said Labor's found its mojo, which was, I guess, a way of trying to say Labor seemed to be hitting the target of saying, you know, we've got an economy that looks like we're going into another or a more prolonged mining resource-driven boom with a strong economy. The Treasurer talked on Tuesday night this week, delivering his budget speech about a patchwork economy. And I think it is a patchwork economy. The danger is it could become a two-speed economy, and the government have clearly got their eye on that. So the Treasurer's opening of the speech said, we want to put the opportunities that flow from a strong economy within reach of more Australians. And I think I agree with Ross. I think it's a strong budget. It's a carefully crafted budget. There are quite a few measures that are complementary and cross-portfolio. I'd agree with everything Frank said about the mental health extra $1.5 billion. That's a $2.2 billion package, and that is just wonderful. We'll be looking for an aged care one from Mark Butler and the Prime Minister next year, and they're on track to deliver, so that's terrific. But the other notable thing, I think, from a welfare perspective or a community service perspective is the participation package. It's got a lot of good things in it. It targets four population groups: long-term jobless Australians, people who've been out of work for 2 years or more, jobless families, teen parents, and people on the disability pension. And it takes a locational approach, which sounds a bit policy boffin, but what that means is it's a relatively new idea coming out of the UK in the last 5 or 6 years, and it's about in a region or in a locality saying, how does everybody get their act together, every level of government, every part of government, every non-government organisation, how do we get it together so that as we're putting supports and services into a region, it's as seamless and as easy for Australian citizens to access as it can be.
So this goes to the case management issue too, doesn't it?
Well, indeed. So what the government have done with the package is they've taken a locational approach. They've targeted four vulnerable groups. Big tick, big tick. They're using some tried and true programs, which are great. But that's all the carrot stuff in the vernacular. What they have, of course, done, as Ross referred to earlier, is they've put a bit of stick in there. So there's still a belief that managing people's welfare payments and having a threat of withdrawing them will motivate people. And while I think it's non-controversial that if you take away someone's household income, you can make them do some basic activities, we know that we can make people turn up to Centrelink interviews. We know that we can make people look for X amount of jobs per week. We know we can do that stuff. The question is, does that punitive approach actually deliver better outcomes? Does it help more people into decent, secure jobs? And does it help more families achieve stability and well-being than using a purely strengths-based approach? And I would say Uniting Care has a big question mark over that.
Ross Gittins, let me bring you in here. One of the arguments used here is that by welfare groups is that our unemployment benefit rate, at that low end, is among the lowest in the OECD, among comparable partners. That is, our benefit rate is pretty low, and the extent to which you can use the stick anymore before tipping people into abject poverty or homelessness is getting pretty close.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I think that the government has for a long time allowed the rate of unemployment benefits to fall well below the rate of other pensions. And I've never been able to understand a decent rationale for that. I think that the explanation for that has to be political. Aged pensioners have got a lot of public sympathy, and the unemployed don't, and sole parents don't. The government creates a lot of problems for itself when it says to sole parents, we'd really like you to get a job, but that means we'll transfer you to onto the payments that are for people who are in the workforce, which is unemployment benefits, and by the way, it'll be $56 a week less. Now, there is no justification for that.
Yet we're facing a situation, and Frank and Lynn, I'll get you both to comment on this, whether you think we are now getting to a tipping point where the benefits are so low that if you do have, so if these restrictions applied to people, you will tip people basically onto the streets.
We are clearly already at that point, John. The New Start payment is the equivalent at a single person of $34 a day. I'd be pretty surprised if many people listening tonight could actually live on $34 a day. If you think about how you would shelter yourself, feed yourself, access medical, dental care if you need it, education, transport, it's just not possible. So what we're seeing more and more is a massive unmet need in the community of people who come to community services looking for crisis help. They come to our emergency relief and family crisis services when they can't pay their rent anymore and they're about to get tipped out on the street. When I was in Darwin last year, I met a family who had actually been locked out, and at that point of their rental accommodation, at that point they came to one of our services. People who have no food in the cupboards to feed their children. I think it's probably easy to sit in Canberra in a government department and think, you know, these are things that will incentivise people. But when you're actually out in the community, and you know, I'm sitting in Canberra tonight at the moment, it's very, very cold outside. When you're looking at people who can't find somewhere safe and warm to sleep at night, or people who are worrying, will they be able to feed their six-year-old child next Thursday when the money runs out? You know, I think we've hit rock bottom.
The other area that's come, and Ross mentioned this too, is the teen parents' incentives. Get into education. Some people have made the observation here too that if people can't fulfil these, you really are placing people in deep jeopardy. Just explain to us what that program is and what the potential advantages and pitfalls are.
Aside from the compliance measures, it's a terrific program. So often what happens when teenage women have babies is they drop out of school. If you're out of school for long enough, it's very hard to find your way back if you're in your late teens or your early 20s. So this is a terrific package that says we're going to support and assist teenage mums back to school and so have them job ready when the time comes for them to have a job. So the elements of the package are some supports and assistances through Centrelink that people will go into Centrelink and develop what the government are calling a participation plan that will not require them to work. It's about skilling up or getting training, going back to high school, whatever it is. And the government, as I understand it, is going to pay all or most of people's childcare costs. So that could but without requiring people to put their child into childcare. If you can manage your, going to school part-time and whatever, that's fine. There are some issues about it and some operational questions. So we need to make sure that...
Yes, are there enough childcare places?
Exactly. Are there enough quality childcare places? Because these are kids coming out of really vulnerable households, and all the evidence tells us for those children, quality, developmentally appropriate childcare can be really beneficial for the child and the parent or the parents. But if it's dodgy childcare, and what we've seen in New South Wales over the last couple of weeks is list after list of unregistered childcare centres in the newspapers, with families still forced to use them because there's no alternative, that becomes a problem. It becomes a problem if schools and training institutions are unwilling to be flexible and provide young mums with, part-time opportunities. So there are, and of course, it is all going to rest on the Centrelink fulcrum. Are Centrelink officers on the ground going to be given the flexibility and the training to work with empathy and respect with these women? If that all works, it could be good. The sting in the tail is if you don't live out your participation plan, your benefits are cut off. So who pays for the nappies at that point?
Yes, and that becomes the question. Who pays for the nappies at that point is also a question that applies across other areas. That is, who provides the rent for the family? I mean, are we approaching, Ross Gittin, something like the American system where your unemployment benefits, I mean, in America it's worse because unemployment insurance cuts out at a certain level and you're forced onto basically subsistence. But are we approaching a level where those benefits now, the baseline, are getting so low as it virtually is close to being subsistence and that's all? That reasonable rents can't be paid?
I think that's a bit dramatic, but okay. It is true that people who, in those circumstances, will quite likely be below the poverty line. They will be in poverty and they'll be finding real difficulty in paying their expenses week by week.
The reason
almost as much difficulty as all those people on $150,000 a year are facing.
The reason I ask the question is because it goes to a philosophy here. What's the philosophy driving it? When a bureaucrat in Canberra is told, can people survive on $34 a day, what does a bureaucrat in Canberra respond? I mean, there is surely, and Frank Quinlan may have some observations here as well after being in the business for many years. Is there a clear philosophy driving this?
Look, what's driving it is politics, and that is there is no general public sympathy for the unemployed or for sole parents, even less for teenage parents.
So it's that cynical Frank.
I agree in part. Ross, but I think it's a sort of false politics because I think there's a lack of general understanding in the community about how hard the circumstances are for people on some of these benefits, and B, how severe the penalties are for people who are experiencing sanctions under this system. So I think if you polled the community and said, look, do you think people should face some sort of penalty if they fail to cooperate with the welfare system that's supporting them? I think most of the population would have some support for a notion like that. If you say to most people in the community, should people who are unemployed and are following all of the requirements that are asked of them by government, should they be living lives well below the poverty line and suffering ill health, including poor mental health as a consequence of that, then I think most people would reject that sort of a premise. And I think if we actually asked people, should the terms and conditions for unemployed people be set at a level that allows them to just rise just that little bit above the sort of chaos that comes with abject poverty, then I think most people would support that sort of a notion. So it's certainly a very unsympathetic and harsh politic in the public space around these issues at the moment. But I think it's largely because the stories of many unemployed people aren't well understood, and the basic intuition that says unemployment's running well below 5%, so if you try hard, you should be able to get a job, is pretty deeply entrenched because it's a myth today that's created by people for whom the labour market was a very different place. When we were searching for places in the labour market, it was very different. Premised around full-time employment, premised around the notion that you could have low levels of skills and still find a job and get a way in. The business people said to me some years ago, you know, there's no such thing as a low-skilled job anymore, and that's part of the problem.
One of the issues, I think, you know, this may well be driven by politics, but I think I also hear a lot of people saying to me there's evidence to support this approach. I'd love to see that in the public space because I don't think we have. Certainly, the first evaluation, for example, of the income management trial in the Kimberley region highlighted the fact that there was and that was focused on families where children were at risk of abuse or neglect. There was a very low take-up rate on financial counselling or financial management courses by participants because they said they didn't need to learn those skills because the basics card managed everything. So it just highlights, I think, one of the problems with this approach. It doesn't build people's capabilities or capacities. So at some point, you're going to have to stop income managing them. And if those individuals and households are not given the opportunity to skill up, they're back where they started. And certainly across the Uniting Care Network, we have research partnerships with some of Australia's largest universities. All of the evidence that we're producing with those universities looking at the programs we're running is that a strengths-based approach works, is effective in getting people into decent, secure jobs and stabilising families. It's not that we're not requiring people to be responsible for their children and their lives. We absolutely are. It's just that you don't need to cross the line and take away their essential household income to do that.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia, through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. We're talking about the Australian budget delivered this week. Our guests, economics columnist Ross Gittins, Lynn Hadfield-Dodds of Uniting Care and Frank Quinlan of the Mental Health Council of Australia. You can join the conversation if you've got a question or two, 1300 800 222. 1300 800 222. Do give us a ring on Sunday night. You may regard the budget as too tough, not tough enough. What do you think of the $150,000 middle income earners? Fit your description? 1300 800 222. Just a couple of questions. Ross Gittins, to you. Let's talk about this government's attitude to employment. 5% regarded as full employment. I remember as Frank Quinlan's indicated, as a young person, I grew up in an era when sort of 2 to 2.5% was regarded as full employment. Why the shifting marker here?
Well, that is a very good question, and I've never found an economist with a very good answer to it. I think probably because the requirements on people are more, because of technology, people are required, more is required of them. I think there are still a lot of unskilled jobs. I mean, there are a lot of people acting as waiters and cleaners, and there are a lot. Most of the hollowing out's actually been in the semi-skilled area, and there are fewer jobs there. But the economists work back, and they just say, "Well, look, from our experience, we feel that when unemployment gets much below 5%, certainly if it gets below 4%, it's only a matter of time before there are such shortages of skilled labour that we have an explosion in wages."
So full employment isn't a real measure of how many are in employment. It's a political judgment about what sort of unemployment level you need to keep constraints on things like wages and inflation.
Well, you can call it political. The economists would call it economic.
But it's a judgment.
Yes, it's a judgment. And economists aren't very dogmatic about this because it's a real suck it and see thing. But some of the things that affect it is that if you have a very severe recession and people lose their jobs, if it's a long time before you can get a new job for them, then those people will find increasing difficulty of ever getting a job, because they lose their skills, they lose their motivations, they become very unattractive to employers. And so this is actually a very big part of my own thinking, which is let's avoid deep recessions, because it's deep recessions that gives you unemployment a lot higher than 5%. We've done that twice in relatively recent history, in the 80s and the 90s. We've so far managed to avoid that since the early 90s. It's a remarkable record. But to me, economic management is all about stopping severe recessions. And stopping severe recessions means caring about things that some people don't care about, which is allowing inflation pressures to build up.
Let's take some questions on Sunday night. Let's go to John in Raymond Terrace in South Australia. Hello, John. You've got a question which you'd like to address to Ross, I understand.
Hi, Ross. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Ross, my question, in terms of tax income from the mining boom and mining tax income and all the rest of it, there's a significant expenditure structure involved in establishing all of these mines and ongoing structure. And there's also a significant lag between the time that expenditure is incurred until the time the income comes in, which has effects on GST and all sorts of other things. How is all that factored in, or is it factored in, and do we understand where it's all coming from in terms of this so-called boom cash money income that's coming into us?
Well, I think we do. And the main thing is that we are now selling all this coal and iron ore abroad, and we are getting unbelievably high prices for that. That money is coming into Australia. Some of it's going back out to the foreign owners of the mining companies, but a lot of it is staying here. A lot of it is being paid in taxes. A lot of it is just circulating in the economy. And the idea that, you know, kind of, I've never seen it, it's never affected me. There are a whole host of channels by which all this money rolling into the coffers of mining companies circulates around the economy. Part of it comes via the government. Part of it comes via state governments. Part of it comes by all the extra money that miners are spending.
Even without the super profits tax.
Even without.
John, thanks for your question. We will move on, brief as it is, to Dave in Hobart. Hello, Dave. Welcome to you. What would you like to say?
Evening, John, Frank, Lynn, Ross. My question is perhaps specifically for Frank, John, and that's for those people with chronic long-term mental illnesses. Quite a few have mental health orders imposed on them. And these orders work within their own state, but as soon as they move across a border, then the order doesn't apply. And, of course, in recent years, the most publicity given to such a case was with Cornelia Rau and the terrible trauma she experienced, partly because there was no interstate cooperation and recognition of mental health orders. And it seems to me that one of the government's focus is on giving money to non-government organisations for those people with relatively low-care mental disturbances. And the ones that were formerly in institutions or would otherwise today be in institutions are not getting the extra care or even the administrative support that interstate recognition of mental health orders would give them.
Frank.
Thanks, Dave. And look, you're absolutely right. I wouldn't want to sow any short-term hope for you about addressing some of these issues, but I would want to say that one of the things that I was encouraged by in the budget was the notion from the federal government that with the states, we needed what they're calling a 10-year roadmap for mental health. I was with the heads of the various state mental health government programs in mental health just at the end of last week. And I heard around that table from each of the states and territories a real eagerness to be working with the Commonwealth to ensure that the programs delivered within state jurisdictions and those of the Commonwealth are coordinated. Now, that's a long way from actually coordinating them. I know that. But I think it's certainly one of those areas where there's been quite a bit of focus on some of these issues, and I sense a lot of goodwill. The government have put some of the money on the table for the states, and the two areas I think in particular that they're looking to work very quickly with the states and to spend some substantial money is in the area of housing and homelessness, but also in the area of hospital discharge arrangements, because as you know, sometimes people aren't passed adequately from one care setting to another, and I think that's the sort of thing that you're talking about. So as I said, I wouldn't want to sow any false hopes for you, Dave, about solving those problems quickly, because sadly the politics of Australia, and John Cleary might well have a session on that another time, the state of the Federation in Australia means that there is a lot of confusion and sometimes out-and-out conflict between states and between the states and the Commonwealth.
Dave, thanks for your observations. So we'll need to move on to Colin on the south coast of New South Wales. Colin, something about disability support pensions.
Yeah, hi, guys. I'm on a disability support pension. I've had three back operations and several other procedures done to my back. I'm on a disability support pension. I'm a single. I live alone. I have to move out of where I'm living. Tried to get a flat of my own. The rent was $210 a week. I have a 9-hour a week job, which pays virtually $135 a week. I was told by a multinational real estate agent that their policy was I had to earn at least $600 a week to pay for a property that was $210 a week. How is one supposed to survive on the disability support pension when everything is so expensive, i.e. rent? I live down the South Coast, country, coastal town. Our petrol is 50.9 cents a litre, and we don't have public transport. So, and how are we supposed to get a job living in a small country town?
Yes.
I think you've just outlined there many of the difficulties that face many Australians in your position. The budget this year was really silent on the question of the adequacy and the equity of welfare payments, all of them, including disability pension payments. The government did commission the Henry Tax and Transfer Review, and one of its key goals or purposes was to look at, were transfer or welfare payments adequate, and were they fair or equitable? At the moment, we've got this very difficult patchwork of payments across the country, where Newstart is $60 less than parenting payment, youth allowance is $40 less than Newstart. There's no real reason for that. It's a historical mismatch. I think it's extremely important that this term the government look at that very carefully, and make sure that we do, as the Treasurer opened his budget speech on Tuesday night to the Parliament, and actually share the opportunity around, share the wealth around from the resource mining boom that Australia is enjoying now and looks like enjoying into the future. I think they're really important questions. How can you pay for secure accommodation? How can you pay for transport? How can you find a job when your options and opportunities are very constrained by the very little money you have to live on the disability pension?
Colin, one of the things we suggested at the last organisation I was at, while I was at Catholic Social Services Australia, was that pensions such as yours, the disability support pension, and payments such as the unemployment benefit, ought to be, the needs of people on those benefits ought to be assessed by an independent commission. So just like an independent commission each year looks at politicians' salaries and says, okay, what's the movement in salaries? What's a fair sort of pay increase? What should we be expecting from our politicians? Just as that happens for politicians, we're saying it should happen for unemployed people and people on benefits. So that's a campaign you might want to think about joining.
Ross Gittins, Treasury don't like independent commissions, do they?
Not on this subject, no. I think it's not a bad idea, but I can imagine the people guarding the money bags blanching at the idea.
Well, I think what they have to do, though, then, Ross, is when they receive that recommendation, is that they then have to expose some of those assumptions we were struggling to find before. They have to say, okay, well, look, there's the recommendation, but we're not going to pay that because we actually want to make it a bit harder, and we want, by making it a bit harder, to encourage people back to work, or we want to punish people, or whatever it is. I think all of those things could be exposed through that sort of a process. Well, and there might be legitimate and good reasons, but I think they should be public and transparent.
Well, one of the things that an economist would say is that the unemployment benefit shouldn't be so high that, relative to, say, the minimum wage, that it robs people of the incentive to work. Well, I mean, that is not an argument that flies. The gap between them is just so great.
Let me turn to something else here that's been raised by these issues, and that is one of the more interesting aspects of this budget is the way that it has been handled by the media. And our discussion tonight has thrown that into relief. We've been discussing the extremely punitive regime of benefits that apply at the low level. Yet nevertheless, there has been an outpouring of outrage in the tabloid media across Australia about the dire plights of people on $150,000 with these cuts being imposed. Cuts of
up to $30 a year, I heard, by one report this morning. That seriously, $30 a year.
Well, yes, except that when you hold a cut-off level in nominal terms, it does decline in real terms.
As in sort of like bracket creep works.
Yes.
But leaving aside whether it's true or not, what's interesting is that many of these same newspapers seem to regard tightening of benefits on the unemployed and on other welfare recipients as responsible, yet restricting benefits received by those higher up the income scale as, quote, class warfare. It was interesting that on today's Insiders program with Barry Cassidy on the ABC, Laura Tingle, the journalist, went some way towards perhaps belling the cat, as she saw it, at least. Then, rather than tiptoe around the issue of media attitudes, she ceased using the euphemistic jargon of tabloid press or some newspapers, but actually named the Murdoch press as a significant player here, effectively running an anti-government campaign that was playing both ends, both screaming about not tough enough on the lower income, yet too tough on higher income people. And given the reach of the Murdoch press throughout Australia, through major tabloids and the dailies around the country, it gives considerable influence in setting the media context in which these debates are happening. Now, this heads I win, tails you lose sort of journalism. Frank and Lynn, is this becoming a significant element in the way there's almost a schizophrenia with the way these issues are approached in this country?
Well, I think sadly this gives an illustration really of the point Lynn was making earlier about the lack of evidence. It's been of great interest to me that the Insiders program, for instance, as you quoted, barely mentioned mental health, and it was the most significant policy initiative of the budget.
But so it was a plus, Frank. We don't want to talk about pluses. We want to talk about minuses.
Well, I'm going to go a step further than that, Ross, and say we don't want to talk about policy. And I think the conversation that Lindsay Tanner began perhaps a week or two before the budget about the absence, actually, of policy discussions in our public space around some of these issues is both frightening and depressing, I think, because the concern is that we do get reporting as if the budget were a football game and as if, you know, you could get ahead with one kick and get behind with another kick, and no sort of sense of the deep challenging, and they are really challenging issues, you know, overcoming mental health, overcoming long-term unemployment, achieving structural change in the labour force. Let's make no mistake, these are really, really difficult social policy problems that some very sharp minds have been working on for decades, and we're going to achieve incremental change over time, provided we focus on what's effective.
Lynn Hatfield-Dodds.
I've been increasingly disappointed with kind of the national media pack overall over recent years, and it has been highlighted in this budget. I think people haven't looked at the details, and Ross, some of the pieces you've written over the last week have been a bit of a highlight for me. I think overall, in spite of my very real issues, Uniting Care's very real issues with the punitive approach, this is a clever budget, a solid budget. It's a budget that people have really thought through how to bring a whole lot of complementary measures together. And on the welfare side with the participation package, there's been a whole lot of easing of testing to get in, you know, an extension of restructuring of the disability support pension eligibility so people can retain some level of payment up to working a maximum of 30 hours a week. These are going to make material differences to people on the ground, yet they've barely been reported in the press.
Lynn Hatfield-Dodds, we'll have to make yours the last word. Ross Kittens, you and I can be excused from commenting on our colleagues in the media.
Well, we can. Probably just as well.
It's been good to have you all with us. Thanks for joining us on Sunday Night.
Thanks, John.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.